Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Dadventures podcast, sponsored by Tonka, because being tough is all about getting out and playing. My name's Nigel Clark and I'm founder of Dadventures and host of this wonderful parenting podcast where we explore different aspects of parenting and hone in on the dad point of view. But it's not just about the dads. Mums, grandparents, carers, soon-to-be parents, we want you involved in the conversation too. So wherever you're listening to this podcast, please, please, please subscribe. It's so important because we can only continue to have important conversations like this if we can prove you're out there listening, and subscribing is the best way to let us know. So let's talk, let's laugh, let's share the things we find difficult and become the type of dads we really want to be. Today's guest is a father of four, a grandfather of four, a fitness enthusiast, and an equal rights activist. He was catapulted into the spotlight in 2020 after an image of him carrying an anti-Black Lives Matter protester went viral. Since then, he's appeared on numerous radio shows and podcasts, and he's here today to talk about his fatherhood experiences. Please welcome Patrick Hutchinson.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. I know you're a busy man, so taking the time out and coming here to talk some parenting and talk dad life, we appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thank you for that introduction. You know, even I was a bit gassed after hearing that.
So, dude, father of four, you've been around the block when it comes to parenting. You've seen the ups, you've seen the downs. Tell us the range of ages of your kids.
So, I have four children, and we start at 31 and we go all the way down to 10. So there's a 31-year-old, there's a 26-year-old, there is a 12-year-old, and there's a 10-year-old. And I have one boy and three girls. And my oldest, my very first child, my son, that's a 31-year-old.
Wow. So, like, most people are probably sitting there thinking, Patrick, you don't look old enough to have a 31-year-old. How old were you when you had your first child?
So we were expecting him when I was 19 and he was born when I was exactly 20. We're 20 years apart.
Do you know what? I've got a similar story my end because I was born 78 and my son was born 2008. So we have exactly 30 years. So we always know. Right. Same thing, same kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So being that young, because in terms of fatherhood and parenthood, that is quite an early age to be introduced to it. Were you ready? Was it difficult? What was the transition like? Because, yeah, it must have been difficult.
Listen, it was extremely difficult. It was an absolute shock to the system. I wasn't ready. But there was one thing I was certain of, and that was that I was going to be there for my son, because I never had a father growing up. And so, you know, it didn't matter how hard it was going to be. I wasn't going to abandon him and I was going to be there. And, you know, I stuck to my guns in that respect. But when I compare the father I was back then to the father that I am now, you know, I do feel a bit sorry for my son, because obviously
we're all growing and learning as we do it. So the first child is always the most unlucky
exactly,
one.
Exactly, yeah. So I've evolved along the way. And I'm a much better father than I was all those many years ago. But I still feel like I did, you know, do him fairly proud. Yeah, I did him fairly proud.
The best you could.
I feel like I have.
Yeah. We'll get into all of that and how you've changed as a father over the years. But you just mentioned something that I want to touch on because I think it's important to pay attention to it in this day and age. So you experienced growing up without a father.
Yes, I did, yeah.
So was that from day dot or was that from
From the very beginning. It was just my mum and my sister, who's 3 years younger than me, on my mother's side. I have other siblings on my father's side. So, yeah, I mean, from the very beginning, I never had a father. It was quite evident to me in the early years as well because, you know, I had friends that did. Yeah, it was, for a young boy, it was a lonely place, man.
I was going to say, did you feel it in, you're quite a sporty person. Was it, daddy isn't there to see me do my taekwondo at age 13, 14. He's not there to see me play football or whatever it is you're doing.
Yeah, exactly that. That encouragement wasn't there. You know, no disrespect to my mum, and I love her dearly, and she was the perfect mother. But one thing she wasn't too fussed about was sports. And where I felt like I, you know, had quite a bit of sporting prowess in my early years, and who knows what I could have been, my mum just wasn't supportive in that area. And most of the time she was too busy working and tired anyway. So I managed to, you know, do taekwondo and a bit of football, but I never managed to take anything to a particular level because my mother either had me looking after my sister or just wasn't interested or couldn't afford it, you know. So a father would have really, I think, definitely helped me in that area.
Did you have any father figures around at the time? Were there uncles around? Was there stepdads? Anything that you could look up to at that point as a male figure?
Yeah, I had an uncle that came down who was 10 years older, my senior, who came down. I'm originally from Coventry. That's where I was born anyway, raised in London. So my uncle came down from Coventry to stay with us for a period of time. My mum thought it was a good idea for me to have an older male around. And that really worked well for me. But obviously for my mum and my uncle, it didn't because he was a young man and he was probably getting up to a little bit of no good, I think. And my mum didn't want a negative influence around me. So as much as I looked up to my uncle and loved him to bits and loved hanging around him and his friends, I did feel, you know, quite safe and secure around them. Having, you know, older boys that looked like me and stuff. My mum wasn't too happy, you know, with him. And so he had to eventually, you know, move on. So I did miss him when he went. I've only ever known my mum to have one partner and his name was Oliver. He passed away actually at back end of last year. He was a really, really good man. Really, really, I liked him a lot. We got on really well. But he always maintained a respectful distance. So he didn't get too close. And I can kind of understand why, I guess, when you're not a biological father to children, you don't want to overstep the mark, I guess. So he was there to support, but he was never like, you know, fully in 100%.
Yeah, it is. You mentioned it and it is a difficult place to be when you don't want to tread on someone's toes as a parent. He probably didn't want to overstep the mark with your mum and how she parents. Sometimes it can feel a little bit awkward when you're in that situation. And you kind of felt that from him a little bit?
Yeah, I did. I felt like he was always, like I said, maintaining that distance, but was there to support when need be. He was very well educated and he would, you know, when I was learning about history and stuff, I was into... the likes of the dictators, you know, the Idi Amin's, the Pol Pot's, the Hitler's, the Stalin's. I was quite interested in why people were like the way those guys were because I was polar opposite to those guys and I was intrigued as to why they were the way they were. And he had a lot of, you know, he knew a lot about that stuff. You know, Karl Marx, he taught me about all these, communism. He taught me a plethora of things when it came to history. And so we had to have these conversations all the time. So he definitely helped me on an academic level, you know.
So you're hearing about Hitler and the way he's going about things. You're hearing about Idi Amin and now you're growing up as a black man in a country that you're a minority in. One, did you notice and did you experience racism? Two, what did you think of it at the time? What was your sort of stance and place on it?
So I experienced racism at a very early age. My first encounter with racism was probably around the age of 9, I think, playing out on my council estate. I lived on a council estate where I, you know, I was a minority. I think there was a couple of Asian families and one other black family, and the rest of the estate were mainly like Caucasians. And I noticed from an early age, like my own friends would, even if they weren't talking to me directly, they would regularly use the N-word in jest, or they would use the P-word, you know, referring to Asian people. If they were going to go to the shops, they would say, "I'm going down to the P-word." They would, you know, they would just, it was just part a way of life for them. And I got used to hearing these words. And then as I got older, I realized this stuff wasn't right. And it always made me feel uncomfortable. And then sometimes in arguments, because, you know, when you're young, you fall out with your friends from time to time. And then the next day, you're friends again, etc. In any arguments or disagreements, could be over footy, whatever, you know, they would use racial slurs against me as well, my own friends. And, you know, I'd have to like sort of take it on the chin and the next few days carry on playing because I never had anyone else to play with and hang out with. And the thing is, if I ever went home and told my mum, she wouldn't let me play out. So yeah, I had to just suck it up, I guess.
When you're black and you are a father in a country that's not your own, bringing up your kids, you think about it a little bit. And you think about which way you're going to go. You think about whether you're going to empower your children and say, look, this is out there, but you're better than that. You can stand up against racism. Or you're going to be a bit more protective and be like, wait, this is going on out there. You need to protect yourself. You need to protect. And there's a fine balance, isn't there?
Yeah.
Because you don't want your kids to be scared of like going out, but you don't want your kids to be unaware that there's harsh racism out there. How have you navigated that?
That actually is probably one of the most difficult things about being a parent as an ethnic minority person. That is probably one of the most hardest things to decipher. You know, you don't want your children to be blindsided by anything if you can help it. At the same time, you don't want to start talking about things that they haven't even experienced and bringing them to the forefront, because, you know, why should you? If they're going along happily in their lives and then all of a sudden you start talking about all this negative stuff, you don't know what kind of impact it might have on them. So it has been difficult trying to navigate that. So like with my two younger children, I never had those conversations with my older children. Just when things, happened, they just sort of happened and we took it from there. But with my younger two, my youngest, she's 10. I don't really talk about racism with her. We haven't really spoken about it with her. She's in that world where she's just skipping along happily and not really noticing anything. My 12-year-old, you know, she is definitely experienced racism, and we've had the discussions. And the interesting thing about my two daughters is that the one 12-year-old, she looks exactly like me, same complexion, everything. Whereas my 10-year-old daughter, she's a lot fairer, a lot more lighter skinned. So I don't know if that has anything to do with the fact that one has experienced it already and one hasn't. But sometimes you do hear, you know, things along those lines. But in terms of my 12-year-old, she was quite philosophical about it, and she wasn't surprised about it. And I think with a lot of the stuff that's happened with me and my book, and I think it's sort of given her a heads up, because obviously when this whole thing happened, she was 10 years old. And I was having the discussions around race. So she was party to all of it. And so I think that kind of helped in many ways her to understand what's going on. And then when she, you know, said that she's experienced various things, it all sort of came as a natural topic of conversation.
So how old, was it 10 you said that you started to have conversations with her?
Well, because of what happened with me in the media spotlight, and obviously everything was centered around equality and racism, it was a way of the subject just being broached for us. And obviously I talk about it a lot in my book, and so it all came out sort of naturally, you know. So yeah, that's how it came about. We hadn't deliberately brought the subject up, but it all came out sort of naturally and authentically because of what had happened to me.
You've brought it up. Let's get into it. 2 years ago, photo of you carrying an anti-Black Lives Matter protester during a protest away from harm went viral, and your life must have changed overnight, right?
Yeah, literally. It was turned on its head, man. I didn't expect what was to come, honestly. But that moment literally changed my life. And let's hope has changed it for the better.
A question from me personally, for you being in that situation, and because there must have been so much going on, was there any confusion from either camp as to what you were doing? I.e., was there anyone in the anti-Black Lives Matter camp who thought maybe you were attacking him and not saving him, and vice versa from the Black Lives Matter camp?
So the way that it actually unfolded, so I'll give you a little bit of background to it. So there were some skirmishes, some fighting going on between the Black Lives Matter protesters and the EDL far-right supporters. But what happens is they ran off and left one guy. I think they were outnumbered and they just ran off. So this guy was on his own. So there was no one from the other side there to support him, to help him. So he was basically by himself with a sea of Black Lives Matter demonstrators. And there was this Rastafarian guy that was trying to help him. There was a staircase which leads up to the embankment. And I think his aim was to try and carry him down the stairs, or help him down the stairs, shall I say, and walk him over to the police. But as he got to the top of the stairs and started walking down the stairs with him, more and more people realised what was happening. Oh, this is one of the EDL guys. And people started to attack him. And the Rastafarian guy, couldn't do much about it. So before you know it, you can't see where this guy is. And there's just a sea of people on the stairs. And so we saw this from a distance and we rush over there and started sifting through people, pulling them out of the way to find where this guy was.
So you had to sift through people to get to him. So he was already probably, it was going south. Yeah. It was going down.
You couldn't see where he was. He was already under a sea of people. And, you're thinking he's getting trampled, kicked to death, whatever. You just don't know what's happening. So it was just rushing over to get people out of the way, pulling them out of the way by the collars of their necks, diving in there. And then we see him lying in the fetal position on about the third or fourth step down from the bottom. And there's some blood pouring from his head. And then, it was just quick thinking. Okay, I just decided to scoop him up onto my shoulder and then walk him over to the police.
Wow. Have you ever had any army training, any military training, anything like that?
No. Just I like to do lots of functional workouts now that I'm older. So lots of squats, lots of walking lunges, lots of deadlifts. So that stuff, I guess, really helped.
I think it really helped, because I don't know many men that could scoop up a man and carry him to safety and have a sea of people around him as well. Yeah. So it's an amazing thing that you did. What's happened since then? Obviously, you've written a book. Had you always wanted to write a book?
I think I speak for myself, but I do know a lot of people amongst my friendship groups where we've always said, the two things on the bucket list would be being in a movie or writing a book. Those two things seem to resonate with a lot of people, and I was no different. I always wanted to write a book, and I always wanted to be in a movie, an action movie in particular, throwing some kicks and some punches and stuff.
Still time for that, Patrick. Still time for that. I'm sure we can make that work.
And so to answer your question, I I've always thought I could, pen up a good book.
Yeah. And that incident, that day, I've seen you talk about it, but maybe other people haven't. And I want you to explain it in your own words. There was no thought that went into that, was there? It was pure instinct for you.
Yeah, I mean, it was instinctive what I did at the time. There was a little bit of quick thinking as to, can I do it? Where would I take him? type of thing. I didn't just want to pick him up and stand there with him on my shoulders. But it was a quick look to the left to see where the police were, look where he was. Am I capable of picking him up? I think I can. Can I get him over there safely? I think I can. And then it was, you're doing it, And I think somewhere along the lines, amongst all of the mayhem and all the confusion and that thinking, I realised, one, I didn't want to stand by and watch what was about to happen and possibly have regrets later on knowing I could have done something about it. And two, then, the thing of the Black Lives Matter, not so much, I don't know anything about the organisation, but the movement in itself, it was important that that wasn't derailed by something as negative of maybe someone losing their lives or being seriously injured. And then obviously what would happen off the back of that would be, you know, probably 3 or 4 or 5 young men, more than likely black young men, you know, being convicted because of what had happened. And so there was all these things. And so I knew the right thing to do was to just scoop him up and carry him out there safely.
I've got a question for you, Patrick. You did an amazing thing. We all know. Has that person ever reached out to you, said sorry, had any contact with you, said thank you, anything?
To be honest, no, I've never heard from the man. At the time it happened, he was a little bit too concussed or intoxicated for us to exchange any words. So I sat him down, the paramedics took care of him, and I sort of went on my merry way. But I've heard nothing from him since then. But something tells me, I don't know, something in the stars tells me that our paths will cross one day. I don't know what it is, but something tells me at some point we'll meet. So, you know, I've got no ill feeling towards him.
I like that. Yeah, I know. And I like the fact that you have that hope. Because I think if, and I'm going to go with you, and when he does contact you, he'll be a different person.
Let's hope so,
I'm hoping he's going to be a different person who wants to have an important conversation that needs to be had by many people all over the world. But yeah, I like it, dude. I like it. I like the hope that you've got for that. You said your life changed. As a family man, as a parent, how did it change? We've already touched upon you had to have conversations with your daughter. But it wasn't just your life that changed, their lives changed as well. You know, you've got kids who are at school who are going to be approached by, you know, their peers, by teachers, whoever. What was it like for everyone, including yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it's been huge. I mean, the first thing was there was also an image of one of my daughters, the 12-year-old daughter. Her name is Sedana. So basically, she was at her friend's house when the news broke and they were watching it on television. So there's a picture of me on the news talking to reporters, and then there's this video of my daughter and her friends watching it in completely in surprise, and my daughter and her friends going berserk, shouting and screaming and like getting really excited because I'm on TV, and that went viral as well. And so that sort of shows you the euphoria and how happy my two young children were when it all happened. But since then, daddy's not available to do all the things daddy's normally doing all the time. So I'm still, you know, doing school runs in the morning, only one way now. I don't really have time to pick her up, but I do take her to school in the morning. Yeah. And I do try and take her to the odd swimming or dance lesson. But a lot of the time I don't do it as much as I used to now. And so they're not as happy now of my new fame as they were in the beginning.
Yeah, of course. Of course, it's difficult. It is. It's difficult to balance everything. But it's great hearing that you're still doing the school run and stuff like that, because part of the ethos of Dadvengers is supporting dads and encouraging dads to be hands-on and be there and get involved and get stuck in, because the previous generations of dads maybe didn't do it as much just because of the way life was, you know, working. And but now we're in a different period and in a different time where family's a bit more about everyone mucking in and doing it together and being there for everyone. Hearing that you are involved in that way is a beautiful, beautiful thing. I want to touch upon the negative side of it. You brought up that your daughter experienced some racism after the iconic event. What about you yourself? We all know that you've experienced the good side of it, but one side that maybe people haven't heard about as much is, have you experienced a bad side as well, like people from the EDL getting in touch or, you know, trolling you online or anything like that?
I'd say a very, very small minority of negativity online, but I block things straight away. I don't respond. I don't get myself mixed up or involved in any of that stuff, and I'm very much a glass half full person. So you know, if I've got 100 messages and I've got one negative message, I'm not going to focus on that one negative message. I'll focus on the 99 positive messages. And that's how I always try to be. And so, yeah, like there has been a little bit of negativity, but I don't focus on it. You know, I absolutely don't focus on it. I don't give it my time or my energy. You know, maybe if there was a lot more of it, maybe I would. But because it's such a small amount, I don't really worry about it.
We live in a time now where our kids are getting into the social media that we didn't have that as kids. because you've seen something go viral, you've seen the ugly, the good side of social media, do you worry about your kids and social media going forward?
Yeah, I do, to be honest. And since lockdown, since what happened with me, it happened during lockdown. So this last couple of years as well, on top of everything else that's happened, the children weren't attending school. I think it's affected my 10-year-old. She's 10 now. She would have been 8, even more so, because what's happened is that they've spent a lot more time on their iPads, you know, on TikTok and social media. I don't know. It's almost like she's just had brain's frozen. She's just gone backwards in everything, you know, and her reports, are sort of reflecting that at the moment, you know, both of them, to be honest, but my youngest one even more so. And it just goes to show. I mean, I bought them the iPads, I think the Christmas of 2020, and yeah, it's the worst thing I ever did. It's the worst thing. It's the worst money I ever spent. I mean, it cost me probably, about 800 quid for each iPad, like with the keyboards and everything, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really regret doing that. You know, my youngest, she's just obsessed and addicted to it. And, you know, you have to give them time on it. And, you know, she doesn't get she's not happy when she's restricted from using it.
So, this is a big one. This is a big one. We've talked about this on Dadvengers. I've talked about it in various parenting panels and stuff like that. Yeah. When they game, when they use iPads, lots and lots and lots, you find that taking it away from them, suddenly they get really angsty. They get really, like, angry and just a little bit, the behavior's off. But when the hours are down, when the hours are way down, their behavior becomes much better. Yeah.
And obviously during lockdown, it was difficult because normally we'd have them doing dance, doing swimming, doing martial arts. And so there's very little time for the iPad. Like, they probably get a couple of hours on the iPad, but most of the time they're out doing things, physical things. But during lockdown, they couldn't do any of that stuff. So it was like they were getting some mad iPad time in. It was like, and it was difficult because, you know, mum's working at home, you know, I'm working from home or out. And it's like,
so it feels very comfortable. It feels very like, oh, well, of course I can get on my iPad because I'm at home, when you would normally be out at dance or whatever. So what do you do to manage it now? Have you, because I know with me, with my kids, I'm an Apple person as well. So we got iPads and iPhones, but we have a family like account. So they've got their Apple IDs and I can shut down their devices like between certain hours of the day. And I can pick amounts of time they can do on an app. So say TikTok, I can schedule it so that they can only ever use 45 minutes of TikTok in a day or whatever. So if it hits the limit, it will shut down and they have to come and ask, can I have more time on that? That's the way I manage it. I'm just wondering if you have a system for managing it or anything.
I've recently started that. Not so much with the 12-year-old because she is so busy with her clubs and stuff that she gets home and she'll get off at the right time. It's just a young one that needs managing. And even now with her, she also does taekwondo, she swims and she goes to netball. So now that, you know, things have opened up again, they're quite busy, so they don't have that sort of time at home anyway. So it's not so bad. It's just getting her timing down a bit. The weekend comes in and she just wants to be on full throttle with it for the 2 days. So it's just trying to slowly reduce her weekend usage. But the midweek usage has definitely been, brought back to something that's a lot more, manageable.
We are so happy to have Tonka as our sponsor this series. Basic Fun's Tonka collection is packed full of fun vehicles for kids who want to get out and get tough with their toys. So dads, you've got no excuse. Grab that mighty steel classic truck. It's time to head to the sandpit for some tough play. You mentioned earlier on that your parenting has changed from your son who's 31 to your kids now who are 10 and 12.
Yeah.
Did you say
12?
Yeah. So how would you say it's changed? What do you think are the biggest changes or the biggest things that you've learned as a parent between when you started and where you are now?
I would definitely say, with my son's concerned versus my daughter's or my son's. So, you know, I don't know, I am a little bit ashamed to say, but maybe not so much to say, but from my background, being from the Caribbean, my mum used to scold me a lot. And so I used to scold my son when he was naughty. Yeah. You know, so that would, you know, class what we would say over in the UK as a clip around the ear from time to time when he was, when he misbehaved.
Yeah. I was the same. My parents were the same to me.
And so, so that's probably one of the biggest changes. Whereas one with my girls, I just find it really uncomfortable. I just find it difficult to hit my daughters anyway, because they're girls. But I don't know if that's a sexist thing. You know, I shouldn't hit my son either, I guess, but it's just how it is. And also the current climate, you do not hit your children. You know, there are other ways to get through to them. Times have changed, you know, so.
Yeah, times have changed. This is a big thing. And I really thank you for being honest and saying the way it is, because I came from a household where I got smacked, you know, I got clipped around the ear. And I know lots of my friends did as well. Yeah. Now, then becoming parents ourselves, normally you're going to, without even realizing it, slip into the way you were parented. Yeah. It's just what you've learned, what you've seen. It's easy to go down that route. So going down a new route when we're in a new age of new ways of doing things and learning new things, to be able to go down that route is difficult, because you have to put in the time, you have to put in the work, you have to see what other parents are doing. You have to think, wait, how do I deal with this then? This, you know, my kid's talking back to me. Back in the day, it was like, clip round the ear, don't talk back to me, done.
Yeah.
Now, you've got to reason that out with words and logic and explanations. And it's a more time intensive process in a time when everyone doesn't have time. So I thank you for being honest about the way you've changed.
Yeah, I think especially when you have smart children, if you have children who are quite smart, they can put you in places in a discussion that you don't want to be in, like things that you would never ever think about having with your mum or your father if you've had one. You know, it's just like one of those things where when we were growing up, it was, you know, you do as you're told and that's it. There's no discussion, you know. But now children will come forth with some arguments, some points that are actually valid. And it's sometimes having to try and somehow shut those discussions down before they tie you up in knots. Like, it's like, yeah, but why? That's good. Like, it's difficult. It's difficult. But definitely the scolding thing, you know, like I said, I never had that issue with my daughters, because I'd never, you know, embarked on hitting them anyway. But my son, and I guess it's a man thing, isn't it? Like, it's growing up when I grew up, you know, to make sure that he was disciplined and stayed on the right tracks, you know, I'll discipline him. So, yeah, you know, my mum had to be the mum and dad for me, and she disciplined me, and it didn't do me any harm. But, you know, everybody's different. And so you have to move with the times. Different. And yeah, I definitely think it, you know, hitting children is not the done thing. But back when I was growing up, it was.
Totally. And I would think that if we went out to the West Indies or went to Africa, there'd still be some parents who believe in that.
Children. Yeah. Some people would say that's why we've lost control of some of the behaviour of some of the children over, you know, just definitely in Europe over here, because we don't discipline them. And that's another argument for another day, I guess, you know.
To touch upon that quickly, do you think children today are a little bit more, let me think of a word here, than we were?
Definitely, 100%. I mean, I'm constantly saying to my daughters, if I said that to my mum when I was growing up, I probably wouldn't be here now. And the amount of times I say that, I probably say that like 3 times a day. That's how bad it is with these young, they don't realise certain things that they say. That's rude. You know, they don't seem to, because it's just a done thing, or the way that they say it, the way that they speak, but they don't seem to understand manners sometimes, you know, no matter how much you try to speak to them. Like if I call my daughters, I don't know if you do this, but when I call my daughters, they can't just answer. They have to say, yes, daddy. If I don't hear the yes, daddy, I'll call them again and again and again and again until I hear yes, daddy. And then I'll tell them what I want.
You work with young people as well, right?
Yes, I do, yeah.
So, and you see, not just with your own kids then, you've seen it with other kids and the the way they are?
Yeah, 100%. You know, I mean, I do a lot of coaching, athletics coaching with some of a lot of the underprivileged children. Some of them do get into lots of trouble in school, but I don't have those troubles with them when I'm coaching because they respect me. I can talk to them on their level. I know some of the slang.
How did you know or build the knowledge to be able to talk to young people and for it to resonate with them and them to respect you enough? Because that's what it's all about. End of the day, they respect you enough to listen to you. How did you learn that?
It's come natural to me, but I think I probably get it from the fact that I've been a parent for so long. So I've been a parent and I've spanned generations. So I've obviously, my son is in his 30s, my daughter's in her 20s. And I know a lot about those age groups. And then obviously then I coach children in their late teens, in their early teens and even younger. You know, I'm up to date with a lot of like the music, for example, that they listen to. And so I understand some of the slang. I use some of the slang when I'm, you know, talking to them, when I'm having discussions with them. And it breaks down the barriers a little bit. They seem to open up to you more when they kind of think that you're a little bit hip or you kind of get it, you know?
Yeah. So the fact that you've been through it with parenting, you've used those things that you've learned, you've used the things that kids engage with and will resonate with to be able to...
That's what I think I've done. That's what I think I've done, yeah. I've used my parenting skills because I haven't been taught how to, you know, speak to children. Well, I mean, I have been. I've gone to various safeguarding things and stuff, but I think the stuff that I do is authentic to me and to people that I work with. We've all got a natural way with children and they just respect us because of who we are and how we speak to the children, you know?
There's a new section to the Dadventures podcast that we're introducing where we let the public tell us like some of the questions that they might like answered. And I've got two here, two great questions from people. First up, this one is from Female First, who trains in martial arts as well, I think. And they've said, how has martial arts helped you become a better father?
That's a really good question. I think martial arts, what it's done for me in life, not just as a father, but I will say in life, is there's a few things, sort of humility, patience. Patience is a really big thing.
As a parent.
Yeah, you need patience, you know, especially when you're trying to learn a new skill and stuff. And like I said, humility and just the self-confidence it gives you and the need, it keeps you calm under pressure, martial arts. It teaches you to sort of, stay calm under sort of really pressurized situations, which I think what helped me on that day, you know. And and that really sort of moves over into parenting for me, because especially when my children have me in a place, sometimes the children have their mums in a place where they shout
where it's a bit
shouting and screaming at them
because they've been because they've been to the shops to get this, they're washing the clothes, they're doing this, they're organising the school trip, whatever. There's just a lot going on.
And for me, I'm just a lot more calmer and serene about things, and I put that down to martial arts, you know, I've been into martial arts a long time, especially when I was a youngster. I used to watch kung fu movies, and I was obsessed with Buddhist monks in particular, and Shaolin monks and Shaolin kung fu, and I think, you know, I could have possibly been a Shaolin monk or a Buddhist monk because I do sort of follow a lot of their tenets it resonates with me. I am not against religion. I do believe in a supreme being and a higher power, but I'm not, you know, a religious person per se. But the religion that really resonates with me would probably be Buddhism, you know, if I had to select one, you know. And so that's why I think it really does carry over into the way that I raise and talk to my children, you know, and it keeps me calm.
Okay, and now our second question from one of our Dadventures community is from Bath and Wiltshire Parent. I think it's a great, great question. The iconic photo of you. What message does this photo pass on to your grandchildren?
That's a good question as well. I think it passes on again. It's, you know, how to be show humility, you know, under provocation. That's what I think it teaches them. And also, I think the thing that jumps out to everybody about that picture more than anything else is that I'm black and the man on my shoulder is white. I think that is a thing that really, you know, pushed it out. If you think about it, had it been me carrying a black guy or a white guy carrying a white guy, I don't think it would have had the same kind of impact as it did. The fact that, you know, I was black, he was white, and, you know, he was there against, you know, the Black Lives Matter demonstration and I was there for it. I feel like that is what created the impact it did. So, yeah, it's just that I think that's what it shows, that to show humility under the face of provocation where you can, and unity, you know, everybody together, you know, nobody deserves to be, you know, put on a higher pedestal than anybody else. We're all in it together. I think that's what the kind of the image it shows.
Yeah, definitely. Tell us a bit about the things you're doing. That I want to be able to promote the things that you're doing, because you're doing some really, really good things. And our time is running out, and I don't want to miss the time to be able to highlight some of the things that you're doing. Now, you started a CIC, a community interest company,
yes,
right?
Yes, I have, yeah. The community interest company is called United to Change and Inspire. And we've got four pillars: education, mental health and well-being, community reform, and the injustice system, we call it, like criminal injustice system, and youth development. Have I mentioned that? Youth development?
No, you
didn't. Youth development. That's... And they're all sort of intertwined within each other. And education is sort of my area within the CIC. So as well as me going into schools, I've gone into schools and colleges spoken to children about the day and why it's important that I did what I did, and you know, what we need to do as a community to come together to stamp out, you know, discrimination of all forms and racism, etc. We've also setting up, or in the process of setting up, an alternative provision. And this is for those children who are unfortunately excluded from mainstream state schools, but they normally are thrusted into pupil referral units. And, you know, there are some harrowing stats that say that once children hit pupil referral units, there's only one place they end up after that. I think some 70% of inmates have confessed to have come from a pupil referral unit in their time before they became, you know, full-time prison inmates. So we're trying to stem that flow, and we're trying to give those children that are excluded from mainstream school an alternative education, more like a tailor-made, almost like private education that is for them to find out their wants and needs, try to help them avoid the pitfalls that they've already found themselves in, and hopefully get them back into mainstream school. So that's where a lot of the funding that we're asking for will go to, the alternative provision.
That's amazing, dude. Really, really amazing. And it makes me want to ask you this question. Do you think growing up that you could have gone either way? Could you have been one of the boys that you helped?
Yeah, 100%. The only thing that stopped me, I mean, I wasn't a saint. I got into quite a bit of trouble when I was growing up, especially when I sort of hit my teenage years and you know, started hanging out with, I didn't want to say the wrong crowd because I was part of that crowd, just started hanging out with other people. The thing that stopped me was the love for my mum. Seeing how upset she was on a couple of occasions when she did have to take, you know, collect me from the police station, to see how disappointed she was, and for me to know how often she worked three jobs on her own, raised my sister and I by herself, often leaving us at home sleeping when she was at work, you know, coming back, taking us to school in the morning, then going to work again, and in the evenings, leaving us with our neighbour, then going to work again. To see the disappointment on her face, that used to break me, and that stopped me from, you know, becoming a full-time criminal. You know, I just thought, no, I'm not, I can't do that to my mother. You know, she's sacrificed too much for us.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny that you say that. I'm currently listening to Will Smith.
Me too. Me too.
Are you listening to it as well? Right.
So, it's amazing, man.
So I'm listening to it. Right. I'm listening to it, and I don't know how far you're in, but he talks about Mama Gigi.
His nan.
And she gave him a look that sculpted his life, and you talking about your mum and the disappointment there, it rings the same truth to me of that like sculpts a person's like trajectory for their whole life. Like a disappointment from one specific person can literally sculpt your
definitely.
Whole life.
Yeah, had it not been for that, I could have definitely, because I have lots of friends that I knew growing up who are still inside now. Many of them have died, you know, so I could have just been one of those statistics easily.
Thankfully, you're not, you're here, you're inspiring other people. And yeah, we're so thankful for that. There's one question that we ask all of the people that come on the podcast, and it is this. If you could have one dad superpower, what would it be and why?
I think my dad superpower would be, so I constantly worry about my children, all of them, even the older ones too, constantly worry about them. And I know this probably would be a bit dodgy because I might end up watching them doing things that they shouldn't, that I wouldn't want to, but I'd be able to maybe switch it off straight away. But I would love to be able to see what my children are doing at any given time. So to know that they're okay and they're safe, because I'm constantly like my daughter is going to be coming home from school in the next hour or an hour and a half, and I won't be there when she's traveling on public transport and everything. And I'd love to be able to just look in on her. Okay, she's cool, and that's it, you know.
Okay, so almost like, and I've thought of a way to make it, because I know you don't want to be voyeuristic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So maybe like a spidey sense that lets you know, like, if your kids are in need.
Yeah.
Dude, I love it. I really, really love that superpower. Season 3 here, and that's another new one for us. So thank you very much for that. Listen, Patrick, thanks for your time. Thanks for speaking so eloquently. You're really someone who's done something amazing and continues to do amazing things. And we thank you. You are now officially a Dadvenger.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Nigel. It's been a pleasure, man. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
What an incredible man. Grew up without a father, but has become an inspirational father who's done some amazing things and continues to do some amazing things. I look forward to seeing what we have next from Patrick Hutchinson. So there you go, another episode done. But what did you think of it? We would love to know. Leave us a review or a comment on Apple Podcasts or on social media about this episode or the series as a whole. And don't forget, if you want to be first to hear brand new episodes, make sure you subscribe by your preferred podcast platform. To find out more about Dadvengers, make sure you head to our website, dadvengers.com, where there is information about our live chats, our dad walks, our blog posts, and more. We'll see you soon.